Welcome to Local Motion. I'm Corey Stanton, and on this program, we'll be discussing soil health and how it directly affects our food systems. In this program, we'll hear from a graduate researcher from Colorado State University who is studying the biology inside the soil, an international rancher who prioritizes his cow's well-being, an agroecologist who travels the world consulting for large-scale farms and ranches, and a soil scientist who's been studying soil on the western slope of Colorado for over 20 years. Soil health is not a new topic, but it does seem to be getting more attention as the public seeks detailed information about where their food is coming from. Consumers are more curious now than ever about the processes, nutritional value, and the overall quality of the food they are eating. Soil health was the main topic at the 8th Annual Western Slope Food and Farm Forum held in Montrose, Colorado in January 2020. KVNF spoke with several of the presenters, including Cortland Kelly. Cortland is a graduate researcher at Colorado State University. She is working on her doctorate degree, and she is currently studying feedbacks between agricultural plants, the soil, and the biology that is inside the soil, with the intention of improving current food systems. I asked Cortland about the importance of microbes.
Microbes are important in actually everything that happens on Earth. There was a really cool kind of conceptual paper that came out a few years ago that imagined a life in which all microbes disappeared and calculated that we would all die within a couple of days. So microbes are responsible for recycling everything. If there weren't any microbes, we would be up to our eyeballs in dead leaves and dead animals. So they are absolutely critical in maintaining all of the cycles of nutrients and all the life that we are so used to on this planet.
Can you give some specific examples of how farm management affects soil health?
So soil microbes are responding to the environment that we create for them. So in agricultural systems, in rangelands, humans are making a lot of changes and we're kind of deviating away from what nature typically does. For ranchlands, we're putting a lot of animals on the soil. We're reducing the diversity of those animals. And often we are changing their behavior so that it's not what a more natural herd of ungulates or, you know, of antelope would be doing. So we need to think really carefully about how we compensate for that in terms of profitability with how we manage our soils and what we feed back to them. So we need to be thinking about letting the soil rest, giving nutrients back to the soil, not taking everything when we harvest, right? So leaving some dead material there for the microbes to use and to be recycled back into the system. You know, natural systems are used to the animals eating that food there and then dying and defecating in that same system. Whereas humans, we take the produce off of the fields and we move it into cities or other urban centers. And then all that waste that's generated from that is completely removed spatially. So we're not getting those nutrients going back in the system. So if you think about, you know, a circle, the circle of life, we are breaking that cycle and moving things around spatially. So we need to be careful that we are replenishing our natural systems so that they can continue to feed and clothe us and do all the things that we require from them. Currently, my research is focusing on is looking at how management affects the microbes. So I have a project right now where I'm looking at wheat variety, so different ages of wheat. We have some ancient grass that was the progenitor of modern wheat, all the way up to some recently released varieties. And we're interested in seeing, is there a breeding effect on the root system and the soil microbes? And how might that be affecting the microbes' activity, their ability to do that recycling function that we require from them? When we think about a specific type of microbe and a really direct benefit, the biggest group that we see that is really important is the rhizobia, which are the symbiotic microbes that associate with legumes. And legumes are types of plants, they're peas, they're beans, they're all of our kind of like high protein plants. And those plants have this amazing ability to create these houses where these special microbes can live, the rhizobia. And these rhizobia has an amazing function that humans have, we recently figured out how to do it, but it's really energy intensive. And that is take nitrogen gas out of the atmosphere where it comprises the majority of the air that we breathe but doesn't actually do anything. It's unreactive. So these rhizobia can take that nitrogen out of the air and through some amazing molecular magic almost, break the nitrogen bonds and turn it into what we call reactive nitrogen, or that's the, you know, the nitrogen fertilizer that plants and animals can use to actually build our bodies, build our cells. And so humans can do this. It's called the Haber-Bosch process, and it takes an immense amount of energy, of heat, and is really an expensive process, especially when we think about kind of both the greenhouse gas emissions from that process, as well as, you know, sometimes it's a very labile or leaky form of nitrogen that can get into our waterways and cause a lot of pollution. So rhizobia have this amazing ability to recreate that process with very little energy, and then they give that nitrogen to our legumes. So when we think about probably the most important microbes to our farming and ranching systems, it's those microbes that are inside our legumes that are creating those nodules and fixing nitrogen out of thin air and turning it into fertilizer that we can use for our plants. So, you know, utilizing that symbiotic system that's already there is an amazing way to facilitate the microbial activity that we want and fertilize our soils.
If some of our listeners who are farmers are interested in becoming very efficient in this way, what's the first step for them?
I have done some work looking at cover crops, and there's a lot of, you know, the research body on cover crops is huge, and it's almost a joke within science that we've been studying cover crops for so long, and yet we continue to be studying them. But that's, I would say, the first step is thinking about how can you incorporate species into your system that are benefiting the soil and feeding the microbes and creating fertility naturally. So incorporating diverse mixtures of cover crops, including legumes, but there are drawbacks. And I have some research on the eastern side of Colorado in the plains where we're looking at cover crops in dryland systems. And there, the competition for water is very high. And so the trade-off between growing a cover crop and growing your wheat cash crop is something that most producers, the math doesn't work out for them. So what we have explored, and the data looks really promising, is planting cover crops in these systems and then using them as forages for livestock and taking that additional income to offset what we typically see as a yield penalty attributed mostly to water loss from the cover crops. So there are really creative ways that you can incorporate soil health management practices into your system without having to sacrifice the economics. And I would say that integrating livestock and being creative with that as well is one way that we could really improve our soils.
That was CSU graduate researcher Cortland Kelly talking about her studies on farm management and soil health. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton, and on this program, we're talking about soil health. Next, we'll hear from rancher Alejandro Carrillo. I spoke with Alejandro at the 8th Annual Western Slope Food and Farm Forum in Montrose, Colorado. Here is Alejandro talking about his ranching practices, including the importance of functional water cycles and how healthy soil impacts his cows.
Soil is actually the foundation of everything. First, very important step is to be able to infiltrate the water. Now, how the water gets infiltrated into the soil is because the soil has some spaces, some air in the soil. Now, what's building that air in the soil is the soil aggregates. And who builds the soil aggregates are the mycorrhizae fungi. And who feeds the mycorrhizae fungi are the green plants. So if you work towards having more perennial, more diverse set of perennials, that means that you will have more green through the year. That means that you will do more photosynthesis. And that photosynthesis will, at the end of the day, put sugars into the roots, which will feed those microbes, which in exchange will feed that plant with minerals. And at the end of the day, you will end up with plants that will be more nutritional dense for your cows, and at the end of the day, for us. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole cycle that, first of all, we as ranchers, we need to understand why we are working towards having more green plants year-round. If we have just bare ground, the water cycle is broken. So obviously, we will get less and less rain, and things are going to get really pretty tough for ranchers. But we can break that vicious circle. One of the first steps would be for the rancher to go and find one of the most productive places he may have. It could be an area that gets a little bit extra moisture through the year, and then do their pilot there. So you can find a spot where you still have some perennial diversity, perennial grasses in your ranch. Go and work on that spot. If there's water nearby, you're done. I mean, you're great. Because water is going to be, at the end of the day, the most expensive infrastructure that you're going to have to invest. Go and first protect them from the cattle so it doesn't keep getting overgrazed. Then fence that out, put the water, get the intensity of the grazing that will make an impact. Because if we leave the paddocks or pastures too big, the impact will be very marginal and people won't get the results within a year. We want ranchers to see the results within their property within a year. So then protect that place, let the grass put a seed head. When the grass, the perennial grasses, put a seed head, even the annuals as well, the cycle is complete. The roots are fully developed and it's ready to be grazed.
Once you establish this area on your ranch, you know, maybe that takes 1 year and then the cattle come and graze. Will it take an additional year to regenerate for the next season?
Yes, usually in our environments, Western U.S., Northern Mexico, where we have these seasonal rains, cycles are once a year. Now, that doesn't mean that you cannot graze before, or that doesn't mean that you can graze every year. It all depends on the rains. So it takes a lot of observation. It's nature. You have to be very flexible. Same deal when how long do the cows are going to stay in a particular pasture or paddock. For ranchers, we need to first put the well-being of the cows. Just by looking at the behavior of the cows, you know if you're on time or you're a little bit late. So if the cows look happy, calm, tranquil, let's move them. Let's move them when they're always full. That's where the observation and the artistic side of this comes into play, you know, because you need to be looking for the well-being of your cows. If you kind of miss on your cows, then that's not good because it's a once-a-year event for the cows. Did they get pregnant or did they not? And pregnancy is directly related to the body condition of the cow. So we need to keep those cows in a good body condition.
That was rancher Alejandro Carrillo talking about the art of ranching and prioritizing the well-being of his cows. You're tuned in to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton, and we're talking about soil health and how it affects our food systems. Next, we'll hear from Nicole Masters. Nicole is an independent agroecologist, an author, a systems thinker and educator. She has been providing agricultural consulting and extension services since 2003. Nicole practices regenerative farming, and she was the keynote speaker at the 8th Annual Western Slope Food and Farm Forum in Montrose. I asked Nicole to describe what regenerative farming means to her and her international team at Integrity Soils.
Well, regenerative is really based on a series of principles in terms of how do we bring life back to soil, how do we regenerate instead of degenerating. So it's based on some very simple principles such as, you know, having a living, growing root all year round, minimizing or optimizing disturbance, integrating livestock, ensuring that you have armor and cover, and ensuring that plants are photosynthesizing well, that plants are healthy so that they're really building soil. And then at the end of the day, we're looking at, are we improving our outcomes? Are we improving the quality of water? Are we improving or decreasing the amount of greenhouse gases coming off a property? Are we increasing biodiversity? Are we even improving the quality of the food that we're producing? So regenerative agriculture is very much around the outcomes rather than this is what you should do or these are the practices that you should do.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about how regenerative farming can affect the human gut.
Well, the human gut's affected by a lot of different things, like not eating a diverse diet, like eating foods with toxins on them, foods that are low in microbial diversity, not eating diverse foods full stop, all has an impact on that human gut microbiome. And as a consequence, we're seeing cascading effects in terms of human health. So what we look to do with regenerative agriculture is we produce crops with nil residues, so we don't have all the chemical-laden food aspects, that we're bringing nutrition back to food. So if you try and grow crops, incredible, you know, like this push for these huge yields, with a lot of nitrogen, they lose the nutrient density and the quality in that. And so I guess it depends what crop you're looking at, but let's say vegetables. Vegetables have lost like 76% of the copper, of the iron. Things like vitamin A have disappeared out of the food system. Vitamin C, the things that we buy food in, most of those are dropped since, you know, 1940s. So we're looking at, well, if we dropped all of that out, how do we get it back? Part of it's due to how plants were bred. Part of it is around restoring that microbial bridge in the soil so that plants can access the trace elements, the minerals, and the vitamins that they need for healthy growth, but that also pass on those health qualities to humans.
Mm-hmm. What is your biggest concern with how, for example, America is currently growing food crops?
I guess I have multiple concerns. Some of them are around some of the chemical treatments that are being used, things like neonicotinoids as seed treatments. I feel like it's something we need to get out of the food chain because of its massive unintended consequences in terms of insects and birds and wildlife and human health and what it's doing to even plants, which is really interesting. But yeah, I guess my biggest concerns is the amount of soil that's being lost in the US. Around 6.7 billion tons of topsoil is being lost off the American continent every year. So it's your biggest export. And so really looking at educating people in terms of you don't need to be losing soil. And in fact, we could be building soil and it's quite simple and cost effective. You know, that 8.6 billion, that's a realized dollar figure as well. You know, we're talking about, oh God, it'd be hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of lost potential revenue for this, let alone all the ecosystems that are collapsing because of having these soil losses or sedimentation in the waterways or the collapse of fisheries, you know, off the Mississippi and all of that. Like, it's all interrelated. So I don't have like one big overarching concern as opposed to, look, this whole system needs to change. The promises of the Green Revolution were not realized. The costs have been far bigger than we ever thought was going to happen. And those costs are now starting to be realized in terms of not having the ability to bounce back, that we're seeing things like these flash floods and then droughts, or we're seeing massive fires. We're seeing water no longer being held in environments. We're seeing all the carbon that should be in soil up in the atmosphere. So for me, everything comes back to soil. So, you know, working with people just to light them up around the potential of soil and how much stuff that we can do. And then, well, it's just incredibly rewarding.
What creates a healthy soil?
So what creates a healthy soil is the plant-microbial relationship. So just the same as it is with our human body, we have this gut microbiome. So basically, the plant outsources things like its gut or its immune system, and everything happens outside of the plant. And so through the plant relating to soil microbiology, they start to build what we call aggregate structure, or that lovely dark crumb. And they start to build carbon, they start to build more diversity of different organisms so that we have a soil that can cope when it does get dry, or it can cope when it gets too wet, that we're building resilience basically to fluctuations in temperature. And this is what we're seeing, is that we don't have any resilience anymore in these soils because these soils are very low in carbon, very low in water holding capacity, and they've blown that microbial bridge basically. So, you know, these healthy soils really are driven by that interaction between functional plants and microbes.
Can you talk to me about the human gut system and what you call the soil gut system?
Yeah, so I think there is an awful lot of similarities between the human gut system and the soil gut system. And a lot of the breakthroughs we're seeing in research is around this microbiome in human health, but actually so much of it relates to the soil. And so I think of that whole digestive system. And then when you think of, you know, like we bite a piece of food and we're going to chew it and we coat that with saliva and enzymes and we swallow it. Well, in the soil, it's things like your ants and your termites and your earthworms that are providing that system, basically doing the very first steps of digestion. And then they're going to break that up, make it smaller. And so for us, we swallow that food, it goes into the gut, and there are acids, really powerful acids that work away. And in the soil, these acids are so powerful, they can actually etch away rocks, and they're created by fungi and bacteria. And then in our system, that passes through the wider gastrointestinal tract, And in there, in your gut, there'd be like 3 pounds of bacteria. And their job is to make it so small it can pass to the bloodstream. But in the process, they're making vitamins and hormones that we can't make ourselves, that are specifically made by beneficial microbiology. So what we're seeing in the human context is issues with depression, issues with PTSD, all sorts of health issues that are related to not having the gut functioning, the microbiome. And so the same thing's happening in the soil, that we've blown this microbial bridge or these bacteria's ability to provide enzymes and vitamins that the plant needs to be healthy. And then at the end of the day, provide food to humans.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about insects. Mm-hmm. And in one of your presentations, you had said that there's a 75% reduction in insects worldwide. Mm-hmm. Why are insects important in farming food crops?
Well, biodiversity full stop is important, but we want to see, you know, if you think of one insect pest, then typically we have about 1,200 beneficials or, you know, insects that are just hanging out in an environment that we may or may not understand what their benefits are. So insects, if you're looking at your, we call it the trophic pyramid, what is happening in soils, then insects are at the top of that. You know, they're the large predators. They're the ones that are shredding materials, decomposing stuff. When they die or when they poop, they're massive contributors for the nitrogen cycle. So we think of them as the nitrogen thieves in an environment. If you've lost 75% of the insect biomass, then we've lost 75% of natural nitrogen cycles in these environments. They are who controls the insect pest. So while we're seeing a decline in insects across the world, we're not seeing a decline in the pests. And in fact, the pest insects are doing even better because they're missing the predators. So there's just so many intricacies and interrelationships with insects that I feel like, you know, we're just barely scratching the surface on how beneficial they are. So if we're seeing a catastrophic collapse like what is happening, that's affecting everything from pollination to soil stability to water quality to nitrogen. You name it, probably has some connection to do with insects.
What are you doing to replenish the lack of insects that are good for the soil?
Yeah, so one of the first steps we can do is to stop killing them, right? So a lot of evidence shows that neonicotinoids and the seed treatments and the pesticides that we're using are actually detrimental to profits, detrimental to yield, and certainly detrimental to the beneficial insects. So those are the first things that we're pulling out. You don't need that stuff. The reason that you need it is because your system's not functioning. Then the next place we look to is diversity. So getting more and more diversity in there. So different types of foods, different types of nectar and pollen and flowers, and having prairie strips or intercropping, cover cropping, thinking about alley crops. So guys are actually planting in, say, lavender and rosemary, which, you know, it just smells beautiful. It makes your place feel really amazing. Or they're putting in shelter belts and trees and just trying to really stack what's the different types of diversity in here, thinking, you know, for insect food, but actually all of those strategies have multiple benefits in other directions. But it's how do we increase that beneficial predator population of insects?
You have a new book out called For the Love of Soil, Strategies to Regenerate Our Food Production Systems. I know that you work with farms and ranches of pretty large scale, but could smaller scale farmers and hobbyists benefit from reading your new book?
Yeah, and it's a good question. When I originally set about writing it, it was really looking at large-scale producers in terms of, hey, if we really want to get the chemicals out of the system and we really want to stop soil degradation, then I need to be speaking to those. But what's been interesting is the feedback I'm getting from people that are home gardeners that are really enjoying just understanding a lot more about how to grow nutrient-dense food and how to reduce pests and weeds without chemicals, and how unaware they were of what's happening in our current food system. So I think the book could feel a little like a roller coaster because it's like, hey, here's all these things that aren't working, but here's all these things that we can do and we can do really, really quickly. So it surprised me to hear from home gardeners and even people that are not gardening at all, like it are just interested either at a policy level or educating in schools. You know, what are we doing currently in our food systems and where this real opportunity lies, because more and more people are asking for clean, nutrient-dense food. You know, that real concern around food safety is getting louder. Yeah, so that's part of what they get out of it. And a lot of people's stories. Like, I think stories are important. And so the book is really made up of people's stories from around Australasia and North America in terms of what are they doing, what actions did they take, what results did they see. And I just think it's really inspiring.
Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was agroecologist Nicole Masters. Next, we'll hear from Montrose-based soil scientist and soil health technical advisor Dave Dierstein. Dave worked for the Natural Resources Conservation Service as a soil scientist for over 30 years and has spent over 20 years in Montrose, Colorado. Dave is also a part of the Western Slope Soil Health Team that was formed 12 years ago. Throughout my research for this story, almost everyone talked about cover crops. I asked Dave if he had any specific advice for cover crops that did well on the Western Slope. Here's Dave Dierstein with a whole bunch of resources for our listening area.
What we've generally seen happen with producers is they'll try a number of different species, and then they kind of narrow them down as to which ones are more successful in what they're doing. And the most success we've had is, as far as row crops, has been covers after sweet corn because they come off early enough. But the options are also there to do spring covers, which would be like before late season planting crops, such as your beans and stuff like that. And some of the places that you can find cover crop mixes would be some of your local producers' co-ops. There is a company by the name of Green Covers Crop Seed that offers a cover crop calculator where you can go ahead and plug in some of your basic information, your goals, and then it will give you an idea of plant species that you could select from.
Oh, that's awesome. Is that a website?
Yeah, if you just go ahead and do a search on Green Cover Seed, you'll get their website, and they offer a free cover crop calculator.
What are some of the biggest challenges in the soil in Montrose and maybe Delta County, if you know?
Well, there's a high degree of variability when it comes to the physical and chemical characteristics of soils. And my position with the NRCS was basically identifying those characteristics, physical and chemical characteristics of the different soils, and posting them on a site called Web Soil Survey, where you can get some basic information of the soils in your area. What I like to encourage people to do is to think of soil health in a different way. You can't think of what you're doing as growing a plant, but what you're actually doing is managing your carbon. And that's really what we're talking about here with the whole process. So the way you build your carbon is to keep the carbon cycling as much as you can within the ground itself. What we've done in the past is we've actually put the carbon back in the atmosphere and burnt up our organic matter. And organic matter in its different forms in the soil is the safest place on the planet to put carbon. If we put carbon in the oceans, what's happening is it's lowering the pH. And as it lowers the pH, the coral reefs are having difficulty, again, extracting carbonate from the water. So soil is where we can safely put the carbon that benefits us. And there's all kinds of benefits to carbon. I call it the magic bullet. When you increase your soil organic matter by 1%, you're putting 20,000 pounds of carbon per acre in the ground.
Wow.
So you can kind of do the math. You know, CO2 levels have basically doubled in the atmosphere in the last 100 years. And that's some of the information that's coming out. I think what you're going to see potentially in the future that's done at a limited basis now is you're going to see people paying to put carbon in your ground.
Well, Dave, I know you have a conference coming up. Give us a little bit of information on that.
Yeah, the 10th annual Soil Health Conference is coming up. It's called the Western Slope Soil Health Conference. It's going to be in Delta, Colorado, February 20th and 21st. And the conference is going to have a lot of different people there, local as well as national, internationally known people that are going to be talking about soil health and a lot of different applications.
Just before the interview, we had briefly talked about the recent farm bill that passed at the end of 2018, and you mentioned there were some soil health incentives. We don't know exactly what those are going to shape up to be, but where could our listeners find more information on these upcoming soil health incentives?
The soil health funding through the farm bill will be coming largely through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS. And so as the information on how this funding was going to be made available comes about, you can contact the local NRCS office in your area. There's one in Delta, and there's one in Montrose, and there's one in Grand Junction. And so you can contact those offices to get more information on how this farm bill funding is going to be allocated.
Great. Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and KVNF.
Thank you very much for your interest in soil health.
That was Dave Dierstein, Montrose-based soil scientist and soil health technical advisor. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Corey Stanton. Be sure to visit kvnf.org for more of our Local Motion programming and for a direct link to several of the resources mentioned in this program. Thank you for listening.